And now, here are your hosts of Lab Radio, sponsored by Coinstructive.
This is Aaron. I am here with Joe Colangelo. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. He's the president of Consumer Research, and he also does some investment work. He'll tell us more about that. We have Chris Groshong here also from Coinstructive. Thanks for being with us, Joseph.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about yourself. How did you get into the arena you are in now?
So I guess there's two questions in that. How did I get into Bitcoin, and how did I get into Consumers Research? Consumers Research is the nation's oldest consumer organization. Been around since 1929. I joined it as the executive director in 2013, and I guess 2012, so about a little over 3 years ago. They were moving from a product review magazine that they had been doing for 85 years to a policy think tank, and they needed somebody to, you know, lead that new direction. So
Cool. It's
really been a great opportunity to kind of take an organization with an 85-year brand history, it's a huge reputation within the Beltway there in D.C., and do it a pivot. You know, so I get to kind of treat it like a startup with this great name recognition. And I was into Bitcoin a little bit before that, and you know, we first started getting invited to speak and kind of educate lawmakers and regulators on Bitcoin, you know, what it meant to them. And you know, the more I learned about the technology, really, the more I recognized the potential that it had, not just to be a fun tool that would, you know, let people do fun new things, but really to fundamentally change the game in consumer protection. To allow, for the first time, consumers to own their own money without having to trust third parties, own their own information, and own their own decision-making abilities. So, you know, our goal is to communicate the opportunity to Bitcoin to lawmakers and regulators, and to communicate the need to follow regulations to the Bitcoin community.
Right.
To client sets.
And you made a funny comment. You said I just think this is so funny. I'm probably going to always remember it. Like, we specialize in congressmen. Like, no, speaking to congressmen, I think, is your exact words. But it's just funny. It's like, our niche is talking to Congress. I'm like, that's kind of a cool niche. Like,
yeah,
very important one to have someone's ear in. So you tell us a little bit about what you were saying about those events you put together in the Bretton Woods and all.
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So one thing that I've always kind of lamented, and I've seen it more, you know, we spent 2 years going to all these Bitcoin conferences. It seems like we're just having the same party all over the world. And we get these really smart people together, and they're all doing amazing things, and we come together for a day and a half, 2 days, and we all talk and then leave. And we miss this real opportunity for collaboration, for combining our own unique perspectives and developing products together.
Mm-hmm. In an ongoing, consistent manner versus these 2-day bubbles that it's like on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's just like, I understand the value of networking and of getting other people's perspectives in a panel setting, mm-hmm. but it seems like just a bit of a wasted opportunity. So we said, let's bring these same group of people together, and instead of, you know, all talking about how great we're doing, kind of check our ego at the door, and we spend time doing a workshop and writing and coming up, you know, testing our ideas against other people's ideas. So we had people, we had from regulators, from the CFPB, the DOJ, you know, all throughout the government, sitting at the same table as, you know, anarcho-capitalists, you know, libertarian, you know, Bitcoin industry professionals that were of the mind they didn't really need regulation. And so, you know, when these people talked over 3 days, we really made a ton of headway, and you know, we're about to release in January a product that's, it's over 100 pages, but it's a white paper for, you know, for Washington, D.C. folks to see what promises Bitcoin has to offer them.
And does it offer any kind of framework that's like somewhat uniform, or is it more just kind of talking points for them to consider as they think about these bigger decisions that are inevitably going to come up one day?
So it's going to show them what framework already currently applies,
okay. Yeah,
what regulations are on the books that the Bitcoin companies should be following. That's anti-money laundering, know your customer, you know, types of things that exist already, OFAC lists, and then there's what should not, you know, what shouldn't be applied. So the way that we outline it is opportunity. You know, the opportunity is to streamline payments. Okay, what are the obstacles to that opportunity? And then what are some of the ways to overcome those obstacles? So if you're a company that specializes in streamlining payments, or, you know, another opportunity like smart property, then you can go to this white paper, which we'll be releasing, and say, okay, what are some obstacles? And have I thought about all of them? Okay, no, I haven't really thought about this obstacle. Wow, this is nice. All these really brilliant people got together, and they, not only did they come up with all these obstacles, but they came up with solutions. So it'll be both for regulators and legislators that need to know more about Bitcoin, and the industry, companies that may want to see what they should be looking out for on the horizon.
I like that. Well,
it really speeds up progress.
We hope so.
I mean, if you get people who are talking about their pain points and also talking about their solutions to those pain points, so when a company helps solve a problem, and they're normally they would do it the way they think they should do it,
yeah,
and they hope that it fits their customers because they think they're doing it correctly, but if the customer is basically providing the solution, then you know that the end product is going to be utilized.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's you think it would make a stream more of a streamlined process.
You think so. Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of these startups, they can't hire, you know, $100,000 compliance person, or, you know, $250,000 compliance person, somebody who knows all the stuff that a bank needs. They cannot hold themselves to the same standard as a bank. And so a tool like this should be able to say, okay, well, here are some things that I don't know that I don't know. And, you know, it's cheap, and maybe I can spend, you know, $10,000 on getting into compliance now that I know that I have to.
Right. Yeah, and 100 pages in D.C. is nothing.
Yeah, yeah, they're like, this is Cliff Notes. Is this the full document?
Sure, that's it. It's only 100 pages.
That's funny. Well, before we jump a little more into that work, which sounds very fascinating, I'd love to learn more. What is your definition of Bitcoin?
I guess Bitcoin is a token that is used to incentivize people to devote computing power to update a ledger.
Okay.
An open source ledger.
And then what is blockchain, which you kind of were starting to go into?
Blockchain is an open source ledger that that anyone can access, and anyone can devote computing power. It is decentralized enough so that it cannot be taken over by a special interest.
Got it. Okay. So So back to your explanation of this, you know, the research firm, like, what was that experience like going from that older model, which I would imagine has like some more old school people will say, and mindsets, and how did they come to this decision that, wow, we need to switch it up and think a little differently? Because that's a huge shift, especially for a company that old. I would totally expect like some old schoolers just being like, no, like the AOL, like Time Warner, like a conundrum. You know, I think there was like the old school with the new school. There's clashes. So I'm just curious culturally how it played out.
I would say that starting in the 1980s, they started focusing a little bit on policy. They started wondering, should the post office be deregulated? What are we doing with these subsidies for these items? It is the nature of kind of like a consumer organization in D.C. to be very interested in policy. But I guess the fundamental shift was that we moved 100% away from product reviews, and that was really just a discussion that had to happen. It was, listen, like, you need to look at your fundamental business model about starting a monthly magazine that runs reviews on products. Consumers these days, they don't, you know, the only people who need this are the ones who don't know how to go on Amazon or CNET or go online, because you're not going to wait around for a magazine in the hopes that the product you want to buy is reviewed by it. You're going to check it out.
Interesting, yeah.
See, the technology gap existed in the 1920s such that corporations had all the information about the product and consumers had none. And, I mean, there were no labeling requirements. There were no disclosure requirements. You could sell arsenic and say, hey, this is arsenic. It's going to, you know, make you feel happy and healthy. And as long as you said it was arsenic, you could sell them poison. And if they didn't know that arsenic was poisonous, they would just drink it. And, you could not get in trouble. The only reason you can get in trouble in the 1920s was if you you said, hey, this is arsenic, and it wasn't. False advertising was the only thing you get in trouble for with a consumer product. So in the 1920s, consumers had no information. So we were formed to say, hey, like, we're going to go out there because consumers, you can't spend all your time and effort getting all this information. Let us do it for you, and we're going to send it to you in a magazine. But this playing field has been leveled by technology, right? So now every consumer is a reviewer. All you need is one person that knows that arsenic is dangerous, and they're going to be able to tweet a photo of a product that has arsenic in it, and everybody in the world, you know, it's going to get picked up by the news. Like, information moves fast, and so we don't have this problem anymore. You're not going to go out and buy sugar-free gummy bears because you know they cause diarrhea.
Right. That's a really interesting switch. So what? So part of it sounded like they were observing consumer behavior and the trends, like, hey, we need to do this just to keep up on a sort of media level, to survive, right? So it sounds like part of it was survival, part of it was just maybe a natural evolution. So now is the focus mainly on blockchain, Bitcoin, whatever else emerges from that as it relates to policy? Or are you trying to also, within the Bitcoins and blockchain space itself, trying to find different insights to provide consumers? So are you sort of taking that consumer report, but for technology angle?
So we're looking at, first off, I should say that blockchain and Bitcoin, it's about probably 20% of what we do. It's a personal passion of mine.
Cool.
But we focus on all sorts of technology, and then energy, healthcare, finance in general. And so, when I was at Money 2020, I was talking about Dodd-Frank and regulations. And then the year before, I was talking about credit card interchange fees. So we do. I love being in the Bitcoin community, and I do it as much as I can.
Nice.
But we also do kind of come from another
many
larger
segments.
Community. And so, with respect to Bitcoin, say that the history of consumer protection is the history of money. When you look at what consumers had to think about when, 300 years ago, they had to think about the trust in that dollar. And it wasn't a dollar, it was a banknote from the Bank of Richmond. And they had to trust that bank that, they weren't going to superinflate that currency. You think about their banking, they had to trust that Wells Fargo was going to have enough armed men at the guard, to guard it, and that they weren't going to overextend themselves and then run out of money, right? Because we had to make sure that, because there was no protection, right? There was no FDIC or guarantees on deposits. Great Depression happened. All of a sudden, when, 260 banks went out of business in the first 3 days of FDR's administration, those people never got a dime, right? There was no FDIC. So they were making these judgments calls. And so all these regulations that have gone into place, like, hey, we're going to replace the Bank of Richmond with a central bank that makes all the U.S. dollars, so we don't have to worry about these banks inflating their specie. We're going to create the FDIC and come up with these rules to govern how FDIC-insured deposits are lent out so that they don't get overextended. All these things are in the name of, hey, consumers don't have access to this information. They consistently misjudge which banks to trust. And they don't have the time or expertise to really figure this out. So all of these things have happened based on the assumption that consumers have to trust third parties with their money. And then we say, all right, well, we all know that consumers have to trust third parties. What can we do? What rules can we impose on these third parties to mitigate the risk to consumers? So Bitcoin comes along and it says, actually, consumers don't have to trust third parties with their money, their information, or their decision-making ability. And so this is a fundamental shift in consumer protection. For the first time, consumers can say, I have $1 million and it is 100% protected, and I can take it with me wherever I go. I don't have to wait for a bank to open. I don't have to wait for anything. I can mathematically program my money to behave in a way that I want and never, and have no fear whatsoever. So this fundamental shift is taking place at the same time that we have more regulations on the books in our entire country's history. And so what we really want to happen here, and I apologize for the rant.
No, this is great.
Our real goal in Bitcoin is to communicate to would-be policymakers that applying the rules that govern 1931 banking deposits to this is basically, it's applying like taxi medallions to Uber, right? Like, they're with the best technology that we had in 1931 was, you know, we came up with the FDIC. Like, we couldn't have come up with multi-sig back then, but now we have better tools. So using old regulations to shape existing new technologies, it's the tail wagging the dog. So that said, Bitcoin has a horrible reputation problem.
Right. So what are some of the challenges in policy itself? And I think this is a good, it's kind of cool that we're kind of really biting into this policy discussion, because super rich, as you well know. So this sounds like there needs to be some social and cultural shifts within government, and that doesn't surprise me at all, because I heard the guy from Optum who fixed the whitehouse.gov debacle, and he went in and said, you know what, he was talking to a tech crowd, guys, this wasn't anything that crazy. It was stuff, problems you've already seen. It was getting them to accept the solutions.
Yeah.
So that almost goes in line with what you were saying about these tools are available, but no one, maybe a lot of people don't care or don't know. What is the challenge to get those people to listen in a different way, or maybe it's part of it is on the community to communicate and craft content in a way that's more meaningful and more easy to, for them to digest? I mean, what are some of the
Well, it's scary. Challenges? I mean, it's really scary for to have this conversation, you know, from a regulator's perspective, because you're basically asking them to, you know, surrender some control, right? And I think there are two things that people can empathize with. You can empathize with there are many things that people can empathize with, but some people associate more with rights, and some people associate more with justice, right? And so you might. So when we see a consumer that has had something stolen from them or paid for a product that did not work, some people say their biggest motivation there is to say, like, I want to bring that consumer the justice they deserve. And so I'm going to even if it means shutting down every single payday lender, and I'm sorry, we're kind of skipping around here, but, like, to use an example, every payday lender out there, you know, I don't want any consumers getting charged too high rates. And then other people who associate more with rights would say, well, you know, I want the opportunity to educate consumers on what they should and shouldn't do, but at the same time, I don't want to just shut down all payday lenders. So when we tie that back to Bitcoin, we say, and we're having this discussion, they say, you know, I could see how a consumer could get ripped off here, and, you know, we need to prevent that. Okay, well, yes, we need to prevent that, but at what cost? And so this is, I'm just framing it as a very scary conversation for them, because they do not, not every one of them sees that, you know, the upside of the internet coincides with, right, the upside of cybercrime, right? Like they would focus more on the cybercrime if this were a 1995 situation.
I think an interesting comparison might be, you know, in California and many other states, you know, there's been this, here, legalization of medical marijuana, in other states, full-on legalization, and some police officers, it's kind of like, I almost think of them as like that regulator old-school mindset. They still think of marijuana as the same hardcore drug, like the same league as cocaine, and they treat everyone as such. So maybe there's these mental shifts that need to happen. Like, those people are like still living in the 1930s framework, so their mindset maybe reflects that. So it's kind of funny that, not funny, but it's interesting that the social challenges, to me, seem to be one of the bigger hurdles, because the tech's there. I mean, all these great people are like showing us all these robust tools on a regular basis at these conferences, but the bottleneck seems to be people accepting, adopting, and utilizing them, right?
I would also say the tech is not there yet for the consumer.
Right? Got it.
For the consumer that wants to have their Bitcoin fully protected, if you're not a
savvy cyber, yourself,
if you're really like not a programmer, like I'll go so far as to say, if you cannot program, you cannot secure your Bitcoin today.
Got it.
There are no real, I mean, there's not a,
like,
trust,
a set it and forget it level safeguard that
exactly
works.
I trust third key solutions. I trust Andreas, and I trust a lot of the multi-sig companies out there, but I wouldn't recommend them as a 100% failsafe. And I also don't think that, so I would say that the tech is not there yet. So when we're having discussions with regulators, it is kind of difficult, because I cannot personally feel like I can point to something and say, look, here is a 100% safe, you know, no zero day exploit. Because come on, I mean, like, you buy a brand new Mac and you download Bitcoin QT, I mean, what do we think? 50% chance that somebody's going to be able to exploit that if you never go to a single website? Because I don't know, maybe it's a 10% chance, right? Mm-hmm. But there are all these exploits out there, and we keep on finding even the most savvy people getting ripped off. So the tech is not there.
Okay. In terms of taking us all the way to cover all this wide swath of like requirements that regulators and just society in general will need, especially the average person that like probably loses their keys or their card now. Imagine trying to send something to this long chain address and do it right, because if you don't, that money's gone.
So I would say outside,
that's kind of scary. Yeah.
Outside of these walls, the tech does not exist to give set somebody up with some Bitcoin and trust that they're not going to have it stolen.
Wow.
So I don't think it's a purely regulatory solution, but I think that best practices should be adopted and implemented and kind of codified in a sort of industry-level document to protect consumers.
So let's, since you deal with, I usually ask people like sort of what they would like to see changed about the industry. What are some things, if you could wave your magic wand, you could change whatever, what would you want to see shifted today?
I would like to have some more grown-ups in the room on the startup side. I think this isn't going to win me any friends, but I think there's this trend where I just keep on seeing, especially in Silicon Valley, just some kids that and it's not their age, it's just that they're adolescent.
It's like a maturity thing.
It's a maturity thing. So I'm not impressed with the and hey, here's this stodgy guy from Washington D.C. Saying that these people need to grow up. I mean, but
you're
not the only one.
I want to just interject and say I've experienced, I'm in L.A. and I've, this word startup is almost, I almost want to just call it something else. Like, I still wanted to have the same energy of what startups represent, but it's so overused that it almost attracts like a sort of purely idea peddling crowd, not as much people wanting to do the work. And kind of like what you're saying, like you're talking about, like there's really hard work involved. And I think maybe some people are still caught in this world of like, I'm going to buy Bitcoin and like become a bajillionaire and go to Aruba. And it's like, actually, no, we have a ton of work to do. And it might require a lot of just grinding it out. And maybe people don't have that reality fully processed or something.
I think they're at camp.
Academia.
Or academia, exactly. Well,
A lot of them are used to a lot of them are really smart people, right? PhD level, like computer scientists, right? They're used to like writing, this is my great idea. And they're like, then they submit it and then they get money to build it
or try to build it.
Right. And that's their mindset is grant money. And so VCs are the grant sources, but they don't have full functioning like to market plans.
Yeah.
Right. And so a lot of the things they turn into science experiments.
So I'm all for the guy who's building a science experiment and doing it for the betterment of the community. I'd love for them to think through their plans a little, their modernization plans before they take on the fiduciary responsibility of in accepting investor money. I guess what I'm more concerned about is the people that lack all sorts of fiduciary responsibility. It's very easy to raise money today, and as a result, I'm not sure that the cream's necessarily rising.
What are some of the opportunities here? Since you deal in the policy space, maybe I'll direct the question more towards like opportunities for governments or Congress in this case, but you can cover any other group. Like, we kind of try to talk to organizations and businesses, so if you have any thoughts for them, great. If not, I'd love to hear what the opportunities are for governments and anyone else you thought of.
So businesses, obviously, if you're listening to this, you probably already accept Bitcoin, but if you don't, you should accept Bitcoin today, and you should save a percentage of it in Bitcoin, or find a vendor that you purchase from whom you purchase that you can pass it on to and purchase your raw goods in Bitcoin. Building this ecosystem isn't just good for you in the short term, it's good for everybody in the long term. And then, you know, for the government, you know, I'll talk to you guys in person. But so I think with everyone in the industry, like recognizing the importance of compliance, and it can be very easy. We make it hard for ourselves when we're reacting to a lack of compliance, and much easier when we're ahead of it. So it's easier to keep up than catch up. I'm not sure if that answers.
No, that's perfect. No, I like that. I actually enjoy coming up on these edges of where we can't necessarily go, because that to me says that we're actually thoroughly examining the issue. Because, you know, with the SEC and just the nature of when you involve money, the rules seem to change. Like, you can't say anything you want. It's, I was just talking with Joe earlier about, you know, compliance and the other. You know, there's just certain arenas you just have to like tiptoe in, and I think that's kind of cool, and it is a little like, wow, that's, I guess don't say that, but it's kind of cool at the same time. How do we get in touch with you, and you know, feel free to plug anything you're working on and what you do. You know, you mentioned you've got a couple multifaceted responsibilities of what you do, so how do we get in touch with you and tell us a little bit about what you know, your projects and everything?
Absolutely. So consumersresearch.org is our website. Twitter handle consumers first, and my Twitter handle is itsjoeco. Yeah, I mean, we're always trying to focus on what's next. So we have broken a couple stories. If the Hill is ever reporting on Bitcoin, we're going to be there. You know, if the Hill is ever taking something up, you bet we're going to be talking to them about it. And really, like, enough people to not enough people contact us directly. So please just contact us directly. Give me a call sometime. I'm at 510-206-1502. That's my cell. Or send a text. And my email is jcolangelo@consumersresearch.org. You know, when I do get an email from someone in the Bitcoin community, I always respond. You know, and we're always kind of like hosting little meetups and doing things. So we love to be part of this community. It's really terrific.
You're a research firm, so it's like, ask us questions, because we have all this research and we need to talk to people about it. That's awesome. And I hope people take you up on that. And was there anything else, any other projects you have going on? Or
I'd say one of our more interesting research pieces recently was a study of all the Bitcoin thefts. And people really think that, you know, I mean, there are a lot of Bitcoin thefts out there, obviously. So one thing that we found, up to 12.5% of all Bitcoins have been stolen. You add up all the thefts.
Holy crap.
So it's pretty remarkable.
Oh my God.
So, but when you look at it, you know, you divide it into, and I don't have the data in front of me, but basically you divide it into like 6-month increments. So for the last, there are about 10 of these, eight of these 6-month increments, right? So like quarter two, 2009 is like the first 6-month increment, and quarter one, 2010. Thefts, basically, the number of thefts, large Bitcoin thefts over 500 Bitcoin, has decreased dramatically in the last year, ever since Mt. Gox. And so I think after Mt. Gox, we're really living in a wild west of, you know, Bitcoin, right? Where if the United States cracks down on something hard enough, somebody can go open some, you know, BTCe in wherever BTCe is based, you know, Russia or wherever, and there's this kind of blow-off valve. So there's regulatory competition. So the market can exist has been existing outside of regulation in many ways, and what we've seen is the market implementing better practices, right? So we've been seeing the implementation of multi-sig, two-factor authentication, you know, security testing, and so this is really fascinating. And then without regulation of exchanges and their fiduciary responsibilities, we are seeing a massive decline in Bitcoin thefts. So maybe it's probably a combination of consumers being more wary of companies, and then companies responding to that wariness by improving their security practices.
Fascinating.
And we'll put that up on the website as soon as I leave here.
Oh, neat. So you're literally about to release that information here.
I mean, we never posted it. It was a talk I gave at a keynote over the summer.
Cool.
I'll make sure to publish that at consumersresearch.com.
Okay. Cool, man. Well, yeah. Chris, do you have anything else to add? Or
no, I just wanted to thank you for coming on.
This was an honor. Yeah, thanks, guys.
Dude, yeah. No, I think it's cool we can kind of give you a voice. You're really passionate. And then you also have this really robust, like, framework you're working on. So, like, I'm excited that in the future you guys are going to, like, be right there on the cutting edge as it relates to policy. So we'll definitely have to catch up more often. You being in research, I think it's pretty clear, like, we could have you on more regularly to kind of check in and update us on whatever you're finding. Because the nature of this space is, like, it's almost like we need to have a constant dialogue. That's why it's kind of cool to do this format and platform, because, like, even a blog might not cut it anymore. Like, we need to just, like, have these really quick conversations and, like, archive them so people can, like, track, like, from when we had conversation one to, like, conversation 100, you know? Like,
you know, I don't know if you follow Mark Andreessen on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Mark Andreessen on Twitter, you know, he's got a couple $1 billion and, you know, a couple million followers, I'm sure, a couple hundred thousand. You know, but sometimes he, like, gets in these conversations with people that have, like, you know, a few hundred followers about stuff that they worked on together in, like, 94. You know, when it was, like, them and 500 other people that were like, the internet is going to be a thing. And you look at them, and I'm always a little bit jealous. I'm like, wow, like, these guys were there, and they could see what was going to happen. And they can now look back and say, even if they didn't walk away with $1 billion, they could be like, you know, I was there. Like, I helped build the first ecosystem around the internet. And, like, my friends, yeah, some of them are billionaires. But so even if, like, I don't end up making money in this whole Bitcoin thing, like, mm-hmm. I firmly believe this is the only opportunity for me to tell my children that I was part of something that really shaped the future.
I like that.
Bitcoin is going to have its day in the sun. And so it is a really special thing. I get kind of jitters.
Chills
just thinking about it.
Right?
This is a sparsely attended, you know, convention of 200 people. One day it's going to be 20,000 people, and we're all going to, you know, kind of give each other a wink and a handshake and say, remember when. So
I like that. That's a nice, like, very inspiring little commentary there. And you're so right. And it's like, we want to be part of that lore. Yeah. We're creating that lore.
Exactly.
By recording this conversation. So I think.
Primary document.
Yeah, there you go. So primary, maybe that we could kind of utilize. I mean, I'm obviously a big podcast fan, media fan, but how cool would it be to utilize some of these content creations as historical record? I mean, in the future, let's assume we have a long digital history ahead of us.
Yeah.
How could that look? That could be kind of cool.
I save all my little pamphlet materials and everything. You know, it's something to look back
on. So next we'll work on the Smithsonian and get them to, like, update and, you know, do some crazy stuff with
the Constructive Museum of Bitcoin. Why not? You know?
Yeah, I like that. Well, hey, Joe, thank you so much for your time. Yeah. Amazing conversation. Lots more to cover. But obviously, I think it's good to have a certain chunk, which is a good overview. And I think there's tons of little other topics to get more granular with. And we can kind of have an ongoing dialogue ourselves. And we'll do it again.
Awesome.
Pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for coming.
Cheers. Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, yeah.